Thank you, John. Actually, I was approached by several individuals just prior to the meeting, giving me their last names and wondering if I was had covered their relatives in one of my books. I think there's a few people with guilty family consciences. However, I did remind them that the Kennedys and the Bronfmans and the Molsons and the Vanderbilts all started out with shady pasts. Actually, President Trump, his grandfather was a hotel keeper in the Yukon. And as the gold rush moved to a different locale, he just put his hotel onto a float and floated it down the river and then beached it and set up a business again. That was supposedly the founding of the family fortune. So for those that were concerned, we call it colorful is what you have as a past. The I should mention my family biography, if you want. 150 years ago, my great grandparents received a free crown land grant on the Monk Road at where it meets the Head River, east of Seabright in the wilds of Dalton Township, which is, of course, now in the city of Kawartha Lakes. And my grandmother, they had seven children, and my grandmother was one of them, born in 1872. And my cotton grandfather, they married and they farmed on Hills Road in Dalton Township, which is just off of Monk Road. The they had a two room log house with a dirt floor, which my grandmother apparently swept every day because there was limestone. She had a limestone floor, and they had 14 children in that house, and my grandmother had eight children, singles, and then at age 42 started having twins. And that finished at age 49, and my dad was one of those twins. So that's sort of a little bit of biography. For a short time, I taught at Lindsay Collegiate, although it was Russian history, not Canadian. And I taught at Crestwood Secondary School in Peterborough. But that's before I got into the land use planning occupation. There was, looking back at the early settlement of Lindsay and the immediate area, there was a problem with alcohol right from the very beginning. And part of it was the folks that settled here, the Irish, and to a lesser extent, fewer Scots, were from a culture of drink. And they brought that over from Ireland with them. And having a wee drop, and I'm talking about the children, and my wife is a Scottish background, and she mentioned that yes, this was something that did happen, that the children were given a wee drop in the morning as eye openers, and at night they were given another drop as eye closers. So alcohol, particularly whiskey, was considered a purer drink than the drinking water, which could give you diphtheria, typhoid, and so on. And it also was cheap and plentiful. And it was just part of everyday life. And every social event had alcohol. And consider that people that were considered essentially abstainers or very, very modest drinkers. The definition was of temperance was five glasses or less a day of ardent spirits. So that's how they defined temperance in the early days. So it gave you a lot of leeway as to how big a glass you were going to consume. And so I have my books talk anecdotally or tell stories about these kinds of social events and these kinds of values and mores that people had. And it was obviously a culture of drink. The other characteristic was a culture of recreational violence. Now, recreational violence to the Irish of that day and the Scots and the English to a lesser extent was going to a drinking establishment. And if you got into a difference of opinion, that a fight would take place. But it was nothing personal. It was just a form of letting off steam after spending a week in the bush in an isolated circumstances, cutting trees down and doing the chores and so on. It was just part of the culture. But the type of fighting that took place related to biting your opponent, chewing his nose off, chewing his ears off, it was quite violent. There were no holes barred. It was sort of, they used to call it Yankee fighting, but it was pretty brutal. And you get numerous criminal court events where people are testifying that their nose was bitten off in this fight in the bar a couple of days ago, and the person who committed the assault is fined 25 cents for the other fellow's nose. I was going to say it's biting your nose off to spite your face, but in the case of Lindsay, 1827, William Purdy set up a gristmill distillery and so on the Scugog River, and there was when the initial survey was conducted in this area, the Crown always set aside a reserve for a mill site, for a sawmill, gristmill, distillery, and these were considered essentials to, these were the founding blocks of settlement. There was also, of course, Crown reserves and clergy reserves. The Crown was for school sites, for example, one out of every seven lots. The clergy reserves were one out of every seven lots as well. And they were, of course, at that time, the early settlement, were for the Anglican Church predominantly. Now, the Presbyterians raised the Dickens, and they wanted, because he was so free land grants. And, of course, the Baptists and the Methodists and the Roman Catholics wanted part of this as well. So there was quite a bit of fighting leading up to the arguing about this free clergy reserve land up to 1837 and the rebellion. Purdy did quite well, but he was an outstanding critic of the Family Compact in Toronto, the people, the governing party, and William Lyon Mackenzie was heading up the reformers at the time. And when the rebellion, the Yonge Street Rebellion, if you want, took place in 1837, and the rebels lost, the people like Purdy, all of a sudden, the population of Lindsay was about 50 to 60 in 1837. And there was a rumor started by a Colonel Murphy in Peterborough, who was the head of the local militia, that Mackenzie was hiding in Lindsay, which was a bit of a hotbed for reformer support. Anyway, the militia, 300 of them, showed up with guns and all the rest of it in Lindsay, scared the devil out of the locals. William Purdy was placed in jail and subsequently lost the mill to the Tory, Colonel Murphy, who had a bit of a drinking problem to start with and basically drank him out of his mill site, drank himself out of his mill site. But those were the politics of the 1830s and early 1840s. The area was variously under the Newcastle district, the Victoria district, and so on, with Cobourg being the district town. If you got in trouble, you were transported down to Cobourg to jail. And this could pose a problem, for instance, if you were involved in some kind of criminal activity. Drinking was shown to be a problem at that time because there was legislation such as the Stump Act that if you were an inveterate drunk who'd been arrested numerous times, you could be put on this sort of road gang cutting trees in a road allowance for public purposes. And, of course, this was part of your sentence under the Stump Act. And at that time, an improved road was the stumps could not be any higher than 12 inches so that the axle of a wagon could get over. There was no macadamization or gravel. There was no drainage ditches. Basically, you just worked your way around the stumps. And, of course, in the spring and fall, when you get an awful lot of rain like we've had, the road got very soft, and the stumps seemed to get higher as the ruts got deeper. So you get people snagged on these things and breaking their axles and so on. So it wasn't a good system. But now, women very early on were involved in leaning toward the temperance side of the discussion, and they were of course the ones, women and children were negatively affected by men that were drinking their wages or drinking the farm earnings away. So the legislation was passed in 1800 to protect the men, the drinkers. And it was called the Nagging Wives Act. Now, the Nagging Wives Act basically stated that if a man came home after a few hours at the pub and his wife started lecturing him about, you know, the family and drinking and spending money in that way, he could warn her that she could be prosecuted, fined and prosecuted. If it occurred on a second time, he could go to a magistrate and file a complaint. The magistrate would have her appear before him and often would fine her for her misbehavior. The third offense was more serious. If she appeared again before a magistrate, she could end up being placed in the stocks or the pillory in front of the courthouse down in Cobourg. And the stocks are the wooden affair with your hands through and your head through. And you often they would put you in the pillory on market day when there was quite a large number of people in town that could witness your humiliation. And the sentence might be 3 hours on a Saturday kind of thing. So women, I guess equality has moved down the field in terms of where women are today. Thank you, dear. I won't state that if only that law were still in place. The lady that was placed in the pillory, or the stocks, was there was a wooden paddle placed on her tongue so she could not argue with her tormentors. And it would have a leather strap on it. And if there was some difficulty, individuals would throw water on her head and the strap would tighten up. So it wasn't a very pleasant experience. Lindsay and the immediate area initially was a square timbered area, and the square timber, two men would cut a large white pine or red pine down and square it on all four sides, wasting about one third of the actual stick, as it was called, and this would then be skidded to a riverbank or onto ice for the spring drive. And they would do about four to five sticks a day. That's about all they could do. And it was primarily for the British Navy, for masts, for the British Navy. So the square timber trade in this area lasted from about 1825 to about 1860, when the saw log business took over. The in order to get access to some of this timber, the river systems were used, first in Corth and then Halliburton, the Burnt River and various rivers. And later, the Monk Road was used in the wintertime, the Bob Cajun Road, which ran north-south, from Bob Cajun up through Minden and so on. They hauled logs down to the major water courses for driving out in the spring. The river drivers were the toughest of the crew. We had the shantymen who actually felled the trees and built the skidways and skidded the logs down that. But the river drivers were the fellows that followed the drive down through the various communities, through Cobequan, through Minden, and so on. This time of year, these towns around here or north of here would be full of river drivers looking for excitement, keeping in mind they'd been in a Cambu shanty for probably from the end of mid-October on. This is now mid-April or later. And they've had nothing to drink of an alcoholic nature because these camps were totally dry. Many of them had not seen a lady in many a day, and they weren't allowed to gamble and so on. So they were looking for some entertainment, some excitement. And Lindsay provided it. Going through the Lindsay Post newspapers in the early times, there are numerous stories about the pest houses, the number of rookeries, the number of houses of ill repute, and the arrests of these ladies. The rule of law was so weak, and the police officers, particularly the chief constables, were corrupt. They were often the biggest customers of these places. And they were complicit with the hotel keepers, who also kept their own ladies, and it was also a source of revenue for their booze and so on. So to fight this, and there were laws, of course, to prohibit this activity of prostitution, vigilante groups kept appearing. And they would burn these houses of ill repute down. They would dynamite them when there were people in, like when there were clientele in these places. They'd dynamite them. They would raid them, smash the windows. They'd beat up the patrons. And most of their most violent activity toward the houses was when the women were incarcerated and the house was vacant. It's interesting to note that the women invariably were not only prosecuted but found guilty, and the men were given a warning and a fine and released. So there certainly was a double standard when it came to the rule of law. The other thing that really put Lindsay on the notoriety map was the number of railways that there were three railways that appeared in town from 1855 or 57 up to 1875 or 1876. And so this was a railway center, and bringing produce in from the lakes, from Lake Ontario, for instance, from Cobourg and Port Hope, but also exporting sawn lumber and various goods manufactured or created in the area. So there were a lot of virile young men who had that were basically headquartered in Lindsay. And they were always looking for a little bit of excitement. So put them in the mix with the river drivers and the shantymen that passed through by the thousands through Lindsay in the fall and came back in the spring heading home. And this is the first bright lights of the big city that they arrive at. And there's all these distractions. So it was a lively place. And the river drivers and the railway guys fought, the Orangemen and the Catholics fought. Like, there were all these groups. There was lots for everybody to do. And one of the major players during this time was a whiskey company called Goodrum and Wirtz. Now, the distillery district in Toronto is still, and I shamefully have never been there yet, but I'll make it one of my bucket list things. A railway was started beside the distillery at Goodrum and Wirtz, which ended up in Cobequal. It came up through Cannington and Victoria Road and so on. And Goodrum and Wirtz financed it for several reasons. They were tired of the firewood monopoly for the city of Toronto. Was controlled by the Northern Railway, which went from Toronto up the west side of Lake Simcoe to Allendale or Barrie, over to Collingwood, and branched through Oromandotte over to Orillia. And that firewood basically supplied Toronto, including a large amount of firewood which was required to run the steamworks at Goodrum and Wirtz. Goodrum and Wirtz wanted to not only cut that guy out, cut the Northern Railway out, but they wanted to have their own supply of firewood. So they got into the railway business, and that wasn't the only reason, but I'll get into the other reasons in a moment. So what they did was they built a railway, and it went up through Cannington and Victoria Road and through Bexley Township up to Cobequal. And just above, about 10 kilometers northeast of Victoria Road, which is on the Trent Severn, south side of the Trent Severn, they acquired 400 acres of hardwood bush and built a siding. And that was going to be their firewood supply area. Now, the cutting was done in the winter, so they contacted a Great Lakes sea captain by the name of Corson, and He said, I will hire the men. You subcontract to me. I'll hire the men. We'll cut the firewood. We'll load it on the in the boxcars, and we'll get it down to the distillery. He hired sailors that were unemployed, Great Lakes sailors that were unemployed for the during the winter. And the sailors organized themselves, and they brought up ladies to while the winter away when they weren't cutting firewood. The I want to just quote from I'm in the wrong book. I want to quote from the Victoria West book. The location became known as formerly it was known as Corson Siding, but it became known by the locals and the Toronto media as Hell's Half Acre. And it states, this is a Toronto newspaper, the sailors would bring with them an abundance of whiskey, an auxiliary corps of prostitutes, and the limits were so aflame with drunkenness and hot uncleanliness that the siding was known throughout the North Country as Hell's Half Acre. So that was one of the things happening. Now, when the railway arrived at Cobequid, there was a whiskey war between the Callahan Gang, a group of Irish on the Burnt River just above Cobequid. And they were notorious. There was quite a large gang, and they were involved in making their own moonshine and selling it to the local hotels. This had no excise tax, so that it was cheap and plentiful, and they supplied all the local hotels. Goodman Wirtz wanted to sell their product, and they were using the railway as a way of getting into the North Country because that was a very lucrative place to do business. They couldn't sell their whiskey at any of these hotels because they had to pay excise tax. So they had about 50 railway workers start to fight with the Callahan Gang, and there were a number of armed conflicts between the two groups until finally the railway group under Goodman Wirtz drove the Callahan Gang out of business and acquired all these sites, all these hotel sites legitimately. One of the other things that Goodman Wirtz helped to their cause was they went to all the hotel proprietors and said, look, we're going to make sure your license is not renewed next year because we know you're acquiring or buying illegal booze, and the government's not getting their tax and the government won't be happy. So they sort of used a two-pronged approach to get their point across and acquire this territory. And they were really the only game in town because they wouldn't allow any other whiskey producers to bring their product in on the railway. So they had to haul it in through some on terrible roads, and which wasn't really going to happen. So they had a monopoly. Another railway which they got involved in was the Irondale, Bancroft, and Ottawa Railway, which started at Furnace Falls or the Bob Cajun Road and went east to Bancroft, and basically paralleled the Monk Road, which ended in the east at Bancroft. They opened up that area for, they opened up 11 settlements and along that route, Furnace Falls and Kinmount and Goodrum and I guess I should look at my notes. Torrey Hill, Wilberforce, Highland Grove, and they were all mostly iron ore, open pit iron ore, which was shipped by rail. So they had the iron ore going. All the hotels that were found in all those little communities, Cheddar was one of them, which is non-existent. Cheddar used to have its own doctor, medical doctor. We think of all the places that are looking for medical doctors today in Ontario, and these places at one time had them. So they had the monopoly on whiskey at these hotels in these 11 settlements. The iron ore workers the iron ore was going out, so they always had freight going out, and for a while things were quite prosperous for them. One of the shifting gears from that, one of the most colorful and famous persons to ever reside in Lindsay was a lady by the name of Pearl Taylor, who married a young local called Hart, and they left Lindsay, and initially she was 17, he was 19, and she was from quite a respectable family. They went off to the Chicago Exposition of 1893, and there, because her new husband was a drinker and a gambler and a womanizer, they sort of parted ways. And she was inspired by going and hearing a suffragette, a talk about women's rights, when saw Annie Oakley perform in Wild Bill Cody's Wild West show. And so she thought, geez, if other women can do this, I can do this. She drifted west into some mining centers and so on in the states, in Colorado, Nevada, became a saloon girl, a singer, a prostitute, learned to shoot a gun, swear and gamble like a man, and ended up robbing stagecoaches in Arizona. Became known as the Arizona Lady Bandit. She needed some money at one point. Her brother had contacted her back from Lindsay, said, "Mom is very ill. You need to come home. You need to come back to Lindsay from Arizona and stay with Mom for a bit." She didn't have any money at that point in time, so she held a stagecoach, got the money, came back. When she reappeared a little while later in Arizona, a posse heard she was around, and they surrounded her and her fellow robber at that time. And she was going to shoot it out, but he gave up, so she sort of gave up as well. They were incarcerated. She escaped from the prison. They recaptured her. They put her in Yuma State Prison. And she had by that time became quite a celebrity. But she became pregnant about a year and a half after her, I think she was serving 20 years or something. But a year and a half into her imprisonment, it was sort of like a Leon's miracle. She became pregnant. And they were worried, the state prison authorities were afraid that this was going to get out to the newspapers, and they'd be the laughingstock. So they quietly released her, and she met a legitimate, respectable farmer, and she farmed ranch the rest of her life, and she lived to be quite an old age. But that's Pearl Taylor Hart, and that's one of your gals. I'd like to talk now about the wonderful community of Omimi. Now, Omimi was settled by Irish, and an early early immigrant to that area from Ireland in the 1830s, described in his journal, writing back to the folks at home about his life in the New World. And he states, and I quote, "We had whiskey on the table for breakfast and one black bottle to serve until noon. And then we had whiskey on the dinner table and one bottle to last until tea and also whiskey for supper. This was the rations for two men. There was no God in those days. Dancing in whiskey and tobacco came first in estimation." So that's 1830s, the impressions of a recent immigrant. In the 1840s, for a community of a couple of hundred that were in Omimi, there were 22 drinking establishments. These are the legal ones. These are not bootleggers. These are the legal ones. A gentleman who went to the Omimi Fair, Fall Fair in Omimi, in the 1850s, observed, "There were bad boys and plenty of them. I don't think the authorities are able to make laws. I think there is no reclaiming Omimi without hanging 50 of the worst boys. And then it would be a warning for the rest. If they would do it, I would buy the rope." Now, after all that, let's talk about temperance. There was old pledge, new pledge, and abstinence. Now, old pledge was five drinks or five ardent glasses of spirits a day or less. The new pledge was beer and wine, but no ardent spirits, no whiskey. The abstinence was abstinence only to a point. If you, and I know there's a retired pharmacist in this crowd, and he's ducking right now, but pharmaceuticals used to be mostly alcohol-based. We know now they're more chemical-based, but I found out just a short while ago that when my kids were small and teething back in the 1970s, we'd give them grape water. Well, grape water is alcohol-based. I didn't know that, but it always put them to sleep and made them docile, and I thought it was good for their gums, but... So alcohol, what would happen then is on Sundays when supposedly the hotels were closed and the general stores could not sell you a bottle or a barrel of whiskey and you couldn't be served on site, that wasn't allowed, but you could buy a bottle, go outside or a barrel and roll it out the door for you and your friends. There would always be a lineup at the pharmacy, usually little old ladies getting their meds for the week because they couldn't go into a hotel to consume. And if they went into a general store, it'd be all over town. But on Sundays, getting your meds, that was usually after church, you'd head over to the pharmacy before you went home. So that was the way the ladies quietly got their cordials and things like that was supposedly through prescription. The women were the leading advocates, of course, of temperance, but the churches, particularly the Methodist Church, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, they were back and forth, depending. The Roman Catholics were the same with back and forth. So the Methodists and Baptists were the principal leaders in the temperance movement. So every year when the new, this is when you had an annual election of municipal officers, municipal councils. Every year when the licenses were being renewed, the Methodists would show up. And they would make a presentation, don't renew any licenses this year, or cut them back, try and control them. So this was an annual battle for many years. But people like Nellie McClung, who was a writer as well, from Gray County originally, Emily Ferguson Murphy from Cookstown in Simcoe County, they were involved heavily in working with the politicians because the Sons of Temperance, the Grand Templars, these men's temperance organizations that did not allow women members and did not allow, of course, women officers, were not doing the job that the women thought they should be. So they formed their own groups. Women's Christian Temperance Union was one of the principal ones. Their founding convention in Owen Sound, up on a high promontory on a beautiful August day, it was flooded with Toronto newspaper reporters. And lo and behold, a sea serpent was seen going through the waters, or something was in there. Anyway, that was the story that got back to the Toronto newspapers, or Toronto people, was that the founding convention of the Women's Christian Temperance Union was seeing sea serpents. So the male bias was there to destroy or discredit women's temperance. Prohibition did occur in 1916 in Ontario, or across Canada, I should say. And at that time, the women that were successful in that, the group of four or the group of seven, as they were known, then switched to women's rights because women couldn't vote. They couldn't own property. 1929, the Persons Act was passed. And that's not that long ago, really. Although, I guess it's almost 100 years now. But 1929, Persons Act. And it was a result, really, of the organizational skills and the lobbying and so on that women had, that didn't have a vote. Women had learned through the fight to toward prohibition and temperance. Anyhow, are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Many books on history, and my wife did the inside cover, and we were close friends. And we go to Pioneer Village up there, which is still there, with railroad from the sea, and all the earlier. And then there was an artist in the area who was very famous, and that's how he made his living by selling his He was the Mondawa King, and his paintings were so great, you can't put a value on them, and they had them in the museum. And there were horses pulling big piles of wood on the wagon. And,
where was the museum?
It's in Minden.
Oh, Minden, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been by it, but I've never been in it. It wasn't open when we were working on this in the winter. Yeah. Cobequan? Minden, Halliburton, Kinmount. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll look them up. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Prohibition in the states I know was 1934 when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, and he repealed prohibition. Canada, it was in the 20s, late 20s, I believe, and I should know that date, and I don't. But that's interesting that there was a distillery here in 1929. There's a new distillery that opened up 100 years after the last one closed in Perth, and they are now making malt whiskey. And that's what the first malt whiskey supposedly in North America was made, manufactured in Perth in 1824. First malt whiskey. And it requires quite a bit more expertise than rye. But, there's now malt whiskey being made in two locations that I'm aware of now in Ontario, if you don't have a preference for rye. Yes, dear. Okay. The Dominion House Hotel is still, of course, in existence in Minden. There are three stories relating to it. One of them is a ghost, a ghost that appears sitting in the window on the second floor from time to time. And this has been going on for over 150 years, that this ghost has been sighted from time to time. There's a story every year or two of somebody in town that doesn't know about it seeing this, walking along the other side of the street and seeing this ghost. Apparently, she was a lady who lived in the hotel and became pregnant. And it was a shantyman or a river driver who was the father who left town unaware that I think the condition she was in. She died in childbirth. Her and the child died in childbirth. And the ghost started to appear. And apparently she's waiting for his return is the story. Another one is a story of a hotel keeper from Guthrum was in Minden drinking one night, and he got into the owner of the Dominion House, recognized him, came over. They started having a few drinks, got into an argument, and they stepped outside and to settle a dispute on Bob Cajun Road in front of the hotel. This is a time after the American Civil War when a lot of people carried sidearms. It was sort of prestigious. Guns had flooded into the country and so on. These guys wore sidearms. And they stepped out and they had a shootout. And the hotel proprietor of the Dominion shot the other fellow, won the shootout, shot him in the chest. The Guthrum hotel keeper fell into the dirt. His friends rushed over, and his dying words were, you know, get me the hell out of this town. I don't want to die in Minden. So that's what he thought of Minden. The other story relates to a young man who's playing poker with the owner one night in the Dominion House, and the owner's losing. The hotel owner's losing heavily. Finally, he bets, puts the deed of the hotel on the table, and said, "I want to put the hotel. I want to bet the hotel." Anyway, he loses the title to the hotel. So the young man takes it home, and the next night he shows up back at the hotel and gives it back to the hotel owner. And the hotel owner says, what are you doing? And the young man says, I forgot my mother's the president of the temperance organization. So that was the end of that winning. Yes, we're going to be going there shortly, the next day or two while we're in town. Any other? Yes, sir. Okay.
I'm just wondering, does the town of Gooderham have anything to do with Gooderham Memorial?
Yes, it does. It's named after Gooderham in honor of, I think it was William Gooderham, donated the money for the Methodist Church, keeping in Gooderham, keeping in mind the Methodists were fighting the whiskey traders and hotel licenses. But he thought they did a lot of good, and he donated money to the Methodist Church to build a church, the first Methodist Church. In honor of that donation, they had a plebiscite, and of course the whiskey drinkers in town supported the plebiscite because they didn't want the Methodists fighting the licensing. And the Methodists and temperance people supported it because he donated money to the church. So they had a plebiscite, and they renamed the community from Devil's Creek to Gooderham. That's where Gooderham came from. Okay. That's a good question.
Okay, John.